Hello, Sublation Media viewers. Thank you for waiting. We accidentally scheduled this stream so that it looked like it was going to start at 6:20 in the morning or something like that, and I had to go in and change it. So if you've been waiting since 6:20 in the morning, I apologize. Today we're going to be reconsidering the WPATH files. We're going to go over some of the criticisms that the report from Schellenberger received. And we're going to be talking about the TikTok man. I'm Douglas Lane, the editor.
And I'm Ashley Frawley. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you Ashley Frawley. I'm the editor of Sublation and CEO and author of Bash Bash Revolution. I always have to plug my novel, Bash Bash Revolution. And Ashley, you have a book out now too?
I do. So you gave a little pause there and I was like, oh, it's my time to shine.
No, sorry. That's okay.
I'm Ashley Frawley. I'm a sociologist and I'm the author of two books. My most recent book just came out in mid-December called Significant Emotions and Word on the Street. It's been nominated for an award. If you go onto my Patreon, you can get a copy of it if you sign up for $15. And you can also be part of group Q&As every month where we all chat together and you can hold me to the fire.
All right. So this is the Sublation Magazine show. We'll see you on the other side of the intro.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets such as military bases and chemical plants may be advised to evacuate.
All right. So, Ashley, we're going to be discussing again the WPATH files. We did that last week. And I received some comments, you know, from patrons and from people who were just leaving comments on YouTube, that we needed to address some of the critiques of the WPATH files, particularly Aaron Reed, I believe is the name of the woman who took on fact-checking the WPATH files. And I want to fact-check the fact-check here today. But you are also working on this. You've been writing for an article about
The WPATH files. I'm writing for Compact Magazine this week, looking at the rise of the phenomenon. You know, obviously, like, trans in some form or some shape or form has been around for a very long time. But there's obviously something else going on here, in the sense that I do think that culturally, we are working through some issues and I'm trying to figure out kind of what is happening culturally, because one of the big arguments that people will make is like, oh, this has been around forever. We're just getting, you know, for anything. They say this for anything that is becoming really powerful, like the rise of anxiety, the rise of depression diagnoses, more and more trans people, whatever it is. And they will often say it's because we are more open about talking about it as a society. However, There are very clear trends in the way that things will rise and fall. And this is actually the topic of my book that has come out, is the way that certain sort of frames for making sense of things appear and relatively disappear in our culture, and trying to explain how that happens and why that happens. So, for instance, what was then called, and I've said this a few times, but what was then called multiple personality disorder in the 80s and 90s went from something that was had existed but was relatively uncommon in the past to tens of thousands of diagnoses in the 80s and 90s. And there were predictions that, you know, every major US city would have a MPD clinic and that there would be like hundreds of thousands. And now it's kind of gone away, not completely, because the WPATH files seem to show that there was sort of a prevalence of dissociative identity disorder and trans identities that practitioners were trying to work through. But I don't know how common that is. But it certainly hasn't just disappeared. But it's not that we are now, are we just like less good at recognizing it? Or, you know, something that was very powerful, became a very powerful way of making sense of specifically trauma and childhood trauma, has now receded. And it's not because we're not as good at identifying it. In fact, over time, the diagnosis has, you know, refined and changed. And it's not that we're not casting as broad a net anymore. If anything, there's a tendency for diagnostic brackets to creep and become wider. As, you know, famous article by Haslam and colleagues talks about concept creep. And there's a tendency for diagnoses and concepts of harm to actually get broader over time. That's certainly the case for a lot of psychiatric diagnoses. So there's something going on in the society and the culture. And that's what I'm trying to put my finger on. Now, the interesting thing is the comments that we got on that stream last week were like the kind of things that you would expect, just people flipping out. And there were also people who were mad at us for being insufficiently critical of the notion that gay people may be encouraged to think of themselves as the opposite gender because they are like effeminate or masculine, this sort of thing. And we had a few gay commenters that were saying that really took issue with
We weren't critical enough of the transgender ideology from their perspective.
From their perspective, and that it was being pushed on them in gay spaces, and that they were being told that they should sleep with, for instance, trans men, and that they had a penis fetish and that sort of thing, and they really resented that. And so that we had some critique from that angle. And I think that's really interesting. So today I spoke with, we'll show you a clip from this, but I spoke with Robin Moira White, who is a trans woman and a barrister in the UK. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to her, we kind of discussed the tendency now for, you know, both sides to become, well, not the tendency now, it's been a while, but like for both sides to be so incredibly polarized that you had Andrew Doyle getting hounded off Twitter by gender critical feminists who are mad that he was using someone's preferred pronouns. And you have equally people getting hounded off Twitter for not using preferred pronouns. And it just, I just think there has to be some sane kind of middle ground here where we can kind of discuss, like, it's a pretty big deal that we are redefining what it means to be a man or a woman. We're going through this as a society. It has pretty profound impacts. Like, are we being literal here about sex? Like, is someone actually changing sex? What does it mean to change gender? And if you like don't literally like pick a side, say a mantra, you're going to get a pile on. And that's not conducive to good policymaking or like us kind of dealing with each other as a society or in a society. So anyways, that's kind of where I am in my headspace at the moment.
Yeah. Well, last week, one of the things I was trying to do in this with the stream, and I'm not sure to the degree to which I succeeded, and perhaps the reason why was because my intention or my aim was incorrect, but was to distinguish between claims of medical malpractice and the issue as a medical issue and the cultural or philosophical or political aspects of the topic. So I thought it was possible that gender affirming care as a model was in error, it amounted to malpractice, just as the WPATH files suggested. And they went so far as to compare it to lobotomies, which were very popular in the mental health arena for a time in the 20th century. And so I thought we could talk about that. And I wanted to claim that we can be reasoned, scientific people without dragging in cultural and political baggage when we analyze these issues. I think that was a bit naive. But I do think it's still worth trying to do that, at least talk about the medical aspect of gender-affirming care and transgender medicine, because there is still quite a lot of debate there. And I also, I guess I want to point out that one of the turfiest journalists in the world, Jesse Singel, actually he's not at all turfy, but Jesse Singel, who's been targeted by GLAAD and attacked by a variety of people who are activists, mentioned in his latest podcast that he had received the WPATH files a full year before this report from Michael Schellenberger came out, and that he decided not to publish it or work with the material because, and the material comes from WPATH forums, so on their website, and anyone could participate in those forums simply by paying a couple hundred dollars a month, a year, to become a member. So you don't have to be a clinician, you don't have to be an expert, you can simply pay your dues and participate in the conversation. And because of that, he felt that it would be very difficult to weed through the WPATH files and pick out those comments that were truly representative of transgender medicine and those that were just ideological expressions from people who joined the organization. I think that because of the way it was curated, you can at times certainly distinguish between clinicians and others in the WPATH files. But I think it's worth noting that the WPATH files are journalism, but it's a journalistic report, but it's also kind of coming from an activist corner, people who have a very definite perspective. And so you have to look for confirmation bias as you go through them. And that's what this journalist who works on Substack did with the fact check.
Before we go into that, can I just address some of the comments? So when I was talking about the response last week, someone said, Secret Asian Dan said, and the host flipping out. Yes. So and for anybody who doesn't subscribe on Patreon, that's where the spicy bits are. So, link down below if you want to get in on that. And you can see, of course, all of our second hour every week going backwards as well. So,
can you got I some quote time you to kill. About how you felt about the Patreon last week? Can I quote
Go
you?
On. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. You said, it was a lot of fun having four men tell me to calm down for an hour. So that was something like that.
No, it was worse than that. It was like, so what if it's male sexuality? Like, get over it, prude. Like, that was, geez, ladies, just loosen up. Feminism is over. Yeah, it's about, don't you know feminism is just giving
I've used that line in so many free, bars, baby. You know.
That was that was the feeling
loosen
that I
up.
Was
Loosen up,
feminism
getting. Is over.
It's my, yeah, no, it's like, no, feminism means come jump on my, essentially, and don't have so many hang-ups. Like, anyway,
I missed the 70s. I wasn't even around then, really. But
no, because I have sympathy for this worry that a lot of women have. Like, first of all, I think there are a huge range of reasons why people is a huge range of reasons why people transition. And, I've talked about this before about, and then Kushlik gets mad at me, where it's like, I have a lot of sympathy for people who are gay, who are attracted to, straight people, and they feel that it would be easier for them if they lived as the opposite sex. You know, I have a lot of sympathy for that. I have a lot of sympathy for like people like Buck Angel who, say, I am a female and I wanted to live as a man, even though she, when she was a butch lesbian, she was a feminist and he is now living as a man. I think that's fine. That's great. I think we should be able to play with gender, that sort of thing. All good. I think, but where I have sympathy is this worry that there is a growing area of male to female transitioners who are doing it because they like it sexually. And they are aroused by the idea of themselves as women. And people, and like you guys were telling me on the stream, oh yeah, but like women get aroused when they're getting ready. No one gets aroused by the sight of themselves. Like literally not a single fucking, you're like
so disappointing to hear that. I'm so sad.
No. And also that. Like you're conditioned to hate yourself as a woman. So like, the idea, yeah, it's just weird. It's a strange thing. And now I don't know how much of that is panic. I don't know how much of that is like, oh, it's just weird. And maybe I should get over my hangups and who cares if it's, but there's like a comment on under one of Robin's videos that was like, we're told as women, we should be okay with men and women's spaces because they like to wear women's panties when they do it. And like, I think it is wrong to just dismiss people as backward relics of a bygone past for being uncomfortable with people in their spaces who are doing it because they get a sexual kick out of it. Now, as I said, I don't know how common that is. Robin said that it's not common at all. We had commenters who were saying it's like a huge number of people. A lot of the people online who have issues, who've put issues forward, they are going through Reddit posts and talking about and showing like all the different ways in which like it's clearly a fetish for some people. And as a woman, that's quite disturbing. At the same time, I don't want to get dragged into a panic. So I don't know, but I have sympathy for that. And I don't think it's right to kind of say like, ladies, loosen up. I think Like we are
generally not a great line. I mean, it's
but we're conditioned our whole lives. Like we're conditioned our whole lives to be agreeable and be nice. Just be nice. Just be nice. And like the women who aren't nice, they get dragged big time, big time. Just be nice. All you have to do is affirm. Well, no, it is a difficult thing. Even if never mind the sexuality thing, just deciding what we mean by sex and gender. Do they mean the same thing? In some contexts, they seem to mean the same thing. They're used interchangeably. In other contexts, you know, it matters quite a lot. You know, what do we do about this? How do we navigate it? In some situations, it's no big deal. In other situations, it is a big deal. Let's have an open conversation about this. And just sort of like tar everybody. So I worry about that. Oh, well, the other thing was that I also have sympathy for what Kushluk is saying, that like there's the issue of like, is it okay to be an effeminate boy? And now you have this ideology around, are we looking at effeminate boys as like, oh, well, that's just one way of being a boy, who cares? Or are we like, oh, flag, you might be trans, right? So this is also really, really tricky. And because, you know, human reality is so, it works so dialectically with our labels and the categories that we use to describe that reality, it has consequences. The dominant ways that we make sense of who we are at a given time have profound influences on what we become. And it's not just like, oh, but it's, you know, it's not a real thing, we're just misdiagnosing something. Well, what's the difference between an effeminate boy who will grow up to be a gay man and an effeminate boy who's really a girl, particularly if you police gender norms so much that like if you like dresses and stuff, you might really be a girl. And people say, well, that's not really what's going on. But then if you kind of push people, it's like, well, I knew because I like dresses. And it's like, why is that bad? You know, anyway, so it's complicated. Anyway, so run the clip with Robin.
Okay, I will. And then I have something to say about, well, let me just say one thing about what you just said. When we get to the critique of the WPATH files, one of the issues that is explored is how do you determine who is actually suffering from gender dysphoria, who actually has an identity issue, and who is simply gender nonconforming. Those are separate categories, and no one really denies that. But there's still the question of whether gender affirming care will sweep people up. That model will sweep people up who are not actually suffering from gender dysphoria, or who might desist on their own, is what's being debated. So let's run this clip though, on what you were talking about.
One of the issues that you see online definitely is this fear among women of this idea that a portion of trans people gain sexual arousal from the thought of themselves as women. In fact, on one of your clips on YouTube, if you look underneath, like one of the top comments is like, we're supposed to be okay with a man in the ladies' room because he likes wearing women's panties while he's there, you know? And so and it's just everywhere. Like they're all, it's like every single trans person has a sexual fetish. That's kind of the idea. There's so many reasons why people transition, never mind the fact that they're like female to male transitioners and so on. But you know, they worry about being forced to play a part in a male fantasy, which is not illegal, but is still something that women find discomforting. This notion that I don't know if this person has a sexual fetish. They might do. And are they getting off on the fact that I have to say that they are a woman? How do we navigate that?
Well, I have to say that analysis, which largely originated by a researcher called Blanchard, has largely been debunked. So that the proportion of trans people, if they are trans people who are doing it for that reason, is once again tiny. There are certainly a few. There are a few quite prominent people who make that statement. It's tremendously offensive to most trans people. I couldn't have put a label on it, but I knew I had this profound sense of wrongness about the way I was perceived publicly from the age of 7 or 8. Now that's not, you know, that isn't a sexual fetish. And it certainly isn't any part of the reason I transitioned. So the problem is that researching the area now is virtually impossible given the toxicity of it. And that slur is just too widely used and too nastily used. It's how do you respond to it? It isn't me. I mean, are we then to exclude lesbian women from female facilities? There was a time. I mean, a very prominent anti-trans campaigner is Martina Navratilova. And there was a time when the papers, because she was a lesbian, the papers, the tennis reports were full of complaints about her or comments about her being around young tennis players, and headlines like Martina is turning young tennis players gay. Well, you know, we learn as a society that that's not how life works. And I'm afraid to say we've got a bit of learning as a society to do about trans people still.
Well, what did you think of that answer, Ashley?
I found it interesting because she seemed to imply, and I'd spoken to her beforehand as well, and she talked about particular individuals in the public sphere who had said that they transitioned because of a sexual proclivity, like that they were attracted to the idea of themselves as women. And she kind of implied that they were, she was like, if these people really are trans, anyway, they're a really small number. And it seemed like it was necessary to kind of downplay that, which was interesting because when we were speaking in the parent room last week, you were all saying, well, who cares? Even if it is a big portion of it, what's the big deal? And, you know, and Secret Agent Dan said, just loosen up, ladies, is a bit of a caricature of Spencer's position, isn't it? I'm not sure that it was. It was like, so what if it's sexual? Like, everybody does things with a sexual drive at the end of the day, you know? And you know, I think the whole like bathrooms thing is really unfortunate because it's so panic driven, like, and it's led to that situation that Robin describes where the people that have like caused a stir in bathrooms are actually just butch lesbians, which makes no sense because the panic is about trans women, so men trying to pass as women, but butch lesbians look masculine. That it's created all of this stupidity and confusion. So I do think the whole bathrooms thing is ridiculous, but at the same time, like, I'm maybe the answer is, and Robin said as well in the interview, like, well, we deal with crime when there's crime. So that's why I said it's not criminal to like be in a women's space because you find it sexually exciting, but it still makes women highly uncomfortable. And I guess, like, I don't know, maybe we lost this one. Maybe women just kind of have to suck it up. Maybe there will be some people who are in that space because they find it sexually exciting. And maybe it's a small number of people. And we just have to tuck those worries into the back of our heads.
Well, I thought there were a couple of interesting things about that answer myself that I want to bring up to see in kind of in response to you as well. So, first of all, she claimed that Ray Blanchard's research had been debunked. Mm-hmm. And I have never encountered what I would think was a completely convincing refutation of Blanchard's research. Not that I think his research is necessarily true, but I just haven't encountered and nothing was cited in that answer. So without more information, my temptation is to think that in Blanchard's research hasn't been debunked. And the reason why I think that is because the way in which the question has been dealt with historically has been antisocial and unethical. So like J. Michael Bailey wrote a book, I forget the name of it. It was something like The Man Who Would Be Queen. I think it was The Man Who Would Be Queen. And he used Ray Blanchard's research to provide the theoretical backbone for what was a popularized accounting of the lives of transgender women or trans women, men who became women. And he was very sympathetic to his subjects. He took the attitude of yes, these are men who get off on the idea of themselves as women, and there's nothing wrong with that. That was his position. But nonetheless, for stating that, he was attacked, you know, in ways that involved even stalking his family and trying to get him fired and all the usual things that you think about when you think about cancellation, but to a pretty high degree. So that was the way in which I know that Blanchard and J. Michael Bailey were debunked. It was by basically a massive amount of social pressure on at times on a criminal level. So that would be the first thing I would say. And then the second thing, though, is that when she moved to the question about lesbians in bathrooms and locker rooms and such, that was actually taking up the idea, well, what if there is a sexual component? And the question is, why would women be less comfortable? Would women be straight women be made uncomfortable with the idea that some of the women in the locker room are attracted to them sexually and are enjoying sharing a space with them and seeing their bodies? And is, as a lesbian woman in a locker room, a problem in the same way that a trans woman who's autogynephilic would be a problem? And so that was, what did you make of that question, Ashley?
I don't know. I mean, like, there aren't that many lesbian women who rape women. So,
right. The problem is not that they're having a sexual enjoyment privately in their head, being there and looking at other women, but rather that the additional threat of rape is in the background when it's
I don't know. I don't know if that's, like, I'm just saying perhaps that's what they would say. The other thing would be, the whole purpose of being there as a woman is sexualized. Do you know what I mean? Like, a lesbian woman goes about her life as a lesbian woman, whereas the idea is that the whole persona of being a woman is its sexuality. So being in that space, now I'm not saying that this is my argument, but if you look at the YouTube videos, if you look at the comments that I mentioned under, for instance, Robin, who's very brave, goes on to GB News. She said that was the 569th interview that she's given, was the one with me today. You can see the comments underneath there, like, that them being there is to get off, that they get off on you having to call them ma'am. And so it's that coercive element to it, the fact that you can't say shit about this, that is so thrilling. And that's the thing that pissed a lot of people off, and that piqued a lot of people, like the whole, like, Yaniv, Jessica Yaniv thing. People are like, oh, well, you know, he was just putting it on. But it wasn't, like, certain whether or not, even to this day, like, am I going to get am I misgendering her, him? I don't even know. So people were, like, disavowed him, but then, like, I don't know. Anyway, but
if you were allowed to misgender whoever you wanted, and that was not going to come with severe either social or even legal consequences, would you be less upset about transgender women who are sexually aroused by the idea of themselves as a woman?
I don't desperately feel the need to misgender anybody. In fact, I'm on the team be nice and refer to people as the gender that they wish to be referred to. I have a problem when that becomes part of a legal issue. That's when I think it starts. If it's not, like, harassing somebody, that, and it's just misgendering because of a belief system. I don't know. We haven't worked this out as a society, but I would err on the side of, you know, as I always do, on freedom of speech and freedom of conscience, even though I would say I would prefer that people be kind. But anyways, on that particular issue with Jessica Yaniv, he was, like, specifically getting off on the fact that these women had to treat him as a woman, and taking them to court. And he was, like, incredibly empowered by this, because he was, like, all his life a beta male, thrown out of, like, spaces, out of society. He would try it on with girls and they were constantly rejecting him. Now he had this new kind of power, and he lorded it over people. And there was nothing that these women could say. They all had to go to these women that he accused of discrimination. They all had to go to a human rights tribunal, spend the money, go through the hell. Like, this woman was describing how she just laid on the couch, in a blur. She couldn't take care of her children. She didn't know, her life was utterly destroyed by Deskyanov, because he was getting off on this. And I don't even mean this in that autogynephilic way. I mean this in just an asshole kind of way, that he was getting off. Yeah, he was a sadist, of being able to stick it to women. And this is a small, tiny little bit of it, but that's a thing that really bothers a lot of people. And this is what has overrun the whole internet discourse. And somebody commented, even this framing is incredibly reactionary. Even that we're talking about it in this way is incredibly reactionary. I think we need to talk about this, because that's the thing that scares a lot of people. And we need to know, even if it's a small number of people, that idea that it's, it could be a sexual predator who's that scares people. And I think too, that was always going to be just discursively, that was always going to be an issue, because we just had the Me Too movement right before the trans issue blew up. And it was Me Too went so far in sort of really souring some of the relations between men and women. You were never going to have women just suddenly be yeah, I'm okay, I'm cool with men, when I'm vulnerable, because now they say that they're women. And I'm not saying I believe this, because I thought Me Too was, there were lots of issues with Me Too, but you could just see discursively in the culture that was always going to become an issue. That was always going to become an issue. So I think we should be able to discuss this openly. And if it is a small number of people, how do we deal with this? How do we make sense of it? And as I said, maybe the way to deal with it is it's probably a small number of people, so who cares? And if somebody commits a crime, then you deal with it when somebody commits a crime. It starts to become a little bit trickier when we talk about things like prisons, we talk about things like sport. And I think, a lot of the stuff, I've been following a lot of anti-trans accounts, and that's pretty much the main thing is the fetish side of it. That's the thing that they really take issue with. And they will put up things from Reddit where my partner is trans, that Reddit. And there are a lot of assholes on there who are manipulating their partners. And I don't think that's a trans issue. I think that's a people being assholes issue. And I think generally we have a lot of this in society where people don't give a shit about each other because they're narcissists. And I think we should be able to criticize people when they're being bullshit narcissists, regardless of what mental health problems they claim, regardless of what other labels they claim, regardless of whether or not they're trans. I think we shouldn't allow people to use flags and diagnoses and so on to excuse what is shitty narcissistic behavior. I think this is probably one of the things that maybe we could do, is it's okay to call people assholes when they're being assholes, even if they're discovering their true selves in the process.
Yeah, it's sad when your true self turns out to be an asshole. And I can tell you from experience. No, okay. Listen, I want to segue. I feel like there's so much that we could talk about there. And one of the things I definitely want to, about what you just said and some differences I have with what you just said, I do feel like male sexuality is this problem that is the culture is trying to deal with. Yes. You said something earlier on that, you said we're redefining what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman. And, and that's brand new, or you may not have said it's brand new, but it's a very big deal for the culture. And I feel like I was born in 1970, and I was born at a time when the culture was trying to figure out what it meant to be a man and what it meant to be a woman. And my entire life, it has been a constant back and forth on that question amongst many others. So I would just remind myself and you and everyone that the problem of gender roles or what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman is not a new one. And it is, I think, a product of our freedom under capitalism. So, this contradictory form of freedom, but nonetheless, a kind of freedom that we experience as a crisis. What's different now is we're trying to redefine what it means to be male and what it means to be female. And somehow
I meant legally when I was saying that. I meant legally, when we talk about like, okay, well, what does this mean for all intents and purposes? We're working that out. But yes, I mean, I used to say when I talked about why like mental health labels have become so powerful, I used to, for years before this trans issue came out, when I was public speaking, I would always say, what does it mean to be a woman? I don't know. What does it mean to be a man? I have no idea. So where do you find these things? In self-help books, in 10 steps, da 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 da. Now, you know, there's another sort of discourse that is talking, is trying to work through all of this stuff, probably instigated by Me Too and this kind of rejection. Like I was on a Twitter X, whatever, talking to, or I commented on Swoletariat's post because someone criticized him for being like toxic masculine for having his squat numbers in his bio. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. Is squatting like masculine? I was just taking the piss, but I'm offended by this. And he was like, no, it just shows that you are like insecure, toxic, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, so it's okay for me, as long as you have the opposite machinery to that toxic thing. So it's okay for me to post my squat numbers because I'm a woman, but it's not okay for him because he's a man. So it's like during the whole like Me Too and feminism coming up, I remember somebody posted a meme that showed like a boy taking a truck off the shelf, and it was like, no. And they showed a girl taking a truck off the shelf, and it was like, yes. You know, or like a boy playing with a doll, or a girl playing with a doll, no. Boy playing with a doll, yes. So it's like, we're still with these gender roles, we've just swapped them. So someone was, sorry, really on my case for like a week. And I was trying to stay off Twitter too, because this fucking cesspool. And this person just kept, basically he wanted to argue with Megan Murphy, but he was coming for me because I was more accessible, I suppose. And I was responding because I'm stupid. Anyways, and he kept saying like, why do you want to police gender roles? Why do you want to make people like have, you know, act in the way that they are for the gender assigned at birth? I'm like, I don't care. You can be a feminine, quote unquote, feminine man. You could be a butch woman. I don't care. I think that's great. The idea that you like, so it's like, it, you can be like, you can play out these gender roles totally, totally toxically or whatever, totally by the book. As long as you have the opposite genitalia, that's fine. You know what I mean? I think it's that we're not really working through this stuff necessarily. I think there's some people, I think there's some people who are sort of like playing with gender, that sort of thing. But every time you kind of push, well, what does this all mean? It winds up coming back to these gender roles. And it's so weird and so foreign to me, because I came from this world like you, where all this stuff seemed to not matter that much anymore. And what we were fighting for was that it didn't matter that much, that there had to be something in society that allowed you not to be bound by your genitalia, right? Like, why would we fight for things like childcare? It's so that, because I have to breastfeed, or against the pressure to breastfeed as well, that I don't fall behind in my career, you know, or because I'm socialized in a particular way as a woman, I don't fall behind in my career, which just fucking happened too, by the way. I'm very angry at men this week. Anyway, and so it's just such a strange, like, people think that we are fighting against gender norms. No, we haven't. We've swapped them around. That's not...
Well, let's listen. We could, I want to talk about the medical side of this, the WPATH side of this, because we only have about 20 more minutes left for this stream, and there's a lot to go through. But look, obviously, when you poke at the transgender question, all the reality of the war of the sexes, the inequality built into society, the different ways of framing those issues, all of that comes spilling out. And we have had, at least like in the 21st century, we've gone through waves of concern about sex and gender again and again, and then it will shift away, but it's never resolved. And the other thing that happens is the old arguments come back. They seem to be resolved and then they come back.
Yeah. And so Satanic Panic was about this as well. Like, changing gender norms bubble up in all sorts of ways. It bubbles up in the obesity crisis. Like, there's an undertone of like, women aren't doing their expected roles. They're feeding their children fast food because they're not in the home anymore. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Right. So, but let's talk about the medical side of it now. Cause, and Aaron Reed is a Substack journalist, and I love Substacks. I'm not, that's not a slam in any way. And wrote this piece called Fact Check, 216 Instances of Factual Errors Found in Right-Wing WPATH Files Document. I wrote down a few of the facts that she checked. And the major fact that was being checked was whether or not transgender surgeries and other medical treatments produce positive outcomes. And that was, it made me feel a little uncertain about Aaron's ability to fact check, because that was one of the facts that she attempted to check, like as if you didn't have to get into the weeds in order to determine that. So I'm going to skip over that aspect, or that first fact that she checked, because I think that you can't resolve that in one go. But the next fact was about orgasms after puberty blockers. And the WPATH files reported that one of the possible outcomes of medical intervention for gender dysphoria would be that you could have a difficulty having an orgasm, that you would have some level of sexual dysfunction, and that there were a variety of ways in which that could occur. Even hormonal treatment doesn't always by any means, but can produce sexual dysfunction. And they quoted in WPATH the president of the organization admitting that puberty blockers, when introduced early in puberty, in what's called Tanner stage 2, which is the earliest stage of puberty, when puberty is presenting, when you can tell that the person's going into puberty, if you introduce puberty blockers at that stage, it is actually, the president said, is 100% likely, but it's obviously an overstatement, that a person will not be able to achieve orgasms later. So Aaron claimed that there were studies showing that you, most of the time, you can achieve an orgasm after a medical intervention. And we're not just talking about puberty blockers here, but the vaginoplasty as well. So she cited a study which was entitled Patient Reported Aesthetic and Functional Outcomes of Primary Total Laparoscopic Intestinal Vaginoplasty in Transgender Women with Penoscrotal Hypoplasia. So penoscrotal hypoplasia, that is when you've introduced puberty blockers in Tanner stage 2, so the penis is too small for traditional vaginoplasty. You don't have enough material there to build a neovagina, so you have to use part of the intestine to create a vagina. And they were studying the sexual function of females or transgender or trans women who had received this procedure. And it's an unclear study. I didn't get I only could read the abstract and some clips from it because I didn't have access to the academic study. It was behind a paywall. But
access to these things, Doug. So time when you're doing this research.
Yeah. But one of the things that's clear is that it does not make any particular claim about sexual function. That is basically, it says that there's a low rate of success with, in terms of sexual function for these women, but that there's a high rate of satisfaction. So they used a variety of surveys to assess the outcome. One of them was a female sexual function survey. The scores there were low. But when you throw in subjective happiness, satisfaction with life, Cantrell's ladder of life scale, the female genital self-imaging scale, and the Amsterdam hyperactive pelvic floor scale, you have pretty good results with this procedure. However, only the female sexual function survey or scale addresses whether or not you're achieving orgasm or climax. And so Reed, in the fact check, conflated overall satisfaction with orgasm and kind of muddied the water and made claims that there was a high rate of climaxing, that the study showed that. And it, from what I can see, that is not the case. If that a low score on the female sexual function would indicate, I would think, a low rate of climax, although maybe that's a very male-centric approach to sexual function.
It is.
But anyhow, we're talking about natal males anyway. So there's that fact check.
Oh no, they have to enjoy levels of sexual satisfaction that are akin with natal women. What?
They should hold on. If I was going in for this procedure, I would want to know that I was going to be able to continue to have orgasms like a man, even as a woman. That's what I would want personally. And I wouldn't want to give that up. All right. Let's see. Then
while you're sort of looking at that next point, there were a lot of comments while we were talking about the fetish thing, like don't get too bogged down in the fetish thing. I think that's good. I didn't want to frame the whole discussion in that way, but I did want to put forward that like that's the thing that's freaking out like most of the people online. And I don't know, like I think we probably need to work through that. And just I don't know, not just fully say, you know, someone commented saying, oh, not all women have such a conservative view of sexuality, Ashley. And again, it's like, so that it's conservative to have an issue with someone in your space possibly getting off on that? Like, I don't think that's conservative. I think like generally, I would like to consent to being part of somebody's sexuality. But whatever, I don't know. Maybe I don't have that right to do that. I honestly don't know what the answer is to that. Maybe it's just like such a small and significant thing, it's no big deal. Probably it is. But the other thing is that, yeah, I don't want all of that to get out of the way of the medicalization question, because that's really what all of this is about. People last week were saying like, oh, well, isn't this kind of like transhumanism and body modification has been going on, you know, throughout human history. And I actually agree with those arguments. Like, I think you should be free to modify your body. I think it's great to be able to transcend our biological differences via technology. I think what this report shows is that we're not really there yet surgically. There are a lot of things we need to worry about with these kinds of surgeries that we should be open and honest about, and not just sort of like talk about it like it's all rainbows and so on. Because I know that there are some detransitioners who are angry that they were not really told the full thing, the full, like, you know, it was just, oh, this is such a great thing. Oh, don't worry. It's not a big deal, this problem that you're going to have. And I think we should be like real about that. But also we should treat it as though it is body modification, you know, not like you will kill yourself if you don't have this. It's affirming your true self. No, you want to live as the opposite sex. There's nothing wrong with that. You want to modify your body to make it easier to do that. There's nothing wrong with that. I think the whole ideology that often goes with this can be a problem, and it can interfere with people making an informed choice about what they're actually doing. They are modifying their body to live as the opposite sex. And they may be willing to live with the range of side effects that come with that. That's fine. But like I was saying to Robin, like I injured my knee some years ago, because Robin always uses the example of knee surgery. Like knee surgery has a really high dissatisfaction rate, something like 30%. And the reason why that is because it's not a great surgery. So I injured my knee years ago and it caused me a lot of problem. I've got muscle atrophy. I fall down flights of stairs. Like I almost fell down a flight of stairs while I was holding my baby. It's a real big problem. And I went to go like get it surgically fixed. And the doctors told me not to. They said, like, don't do it. It's going to introduce all kinds of problems later in life.
because it's not a great surgery. So like, you know, or people would who were with children who were going through premature puberty before puberty blockers were being offered to trans children, at least to the extent they are now. And it's a bit iffy, like, and unclear exactly how many children are actually being offered this, at least in the UK. But they were like, you know, don't touch this stuff. It's serious business. Like, it can cause osteoporosis and things like that. Like, really think it through if you want to put your child through this. Like, puberty at that age might be better than putting your child through this stuff. So I think we just need to be a little bit more real about what's going on here. And I feel like any kind of reluctance or like in the WPATH files, they even talk about like, oh, well, the whole thing about doing an extensive examination with somebody, you know, to make sure this is really what they want to do. Oh, even that is causing inequalities in care. We should, you know, lower the burden. Lower the threshold, that is, of what it takes to actually get this kind of treatment. It's life-saving treatment, that sort of thing. It was just like full steam ahead. And I feel like at best, I think it's, let's just slow down a little bit here and really be real about what we're talking about. These are quite serious surgeries with lifelong effects. Sorry.
So, of course, one of the big problems that the WPATH files points to is the difficulty in getting informed consent. No one's really claiming that you can't or should be barred from getting any of these procedures, but rather that a lot of this has to do with informed consent for children and also for adults who may be suffering from mental illness that hinders their ability to give informed consent. But in any case, the first fact check that I really analyzed from Aaron Reed, to me, it was not a fact check, and the facts did not support the conclusion that Aaron Reed reached. The next fact check, Aaron Reed claims that the WPATH files conflate gender identity and sexuality and says this is a factual error. In reality, I don't think this question can be settled on a strictly empirical basis. Her refutation of the claim that transgender surgeries are a kind of conversion therapy for homosexuals is that the majority of transgender individuals do not identify as straight after transitioning. Now, to me, this only speaks to ideological confusion. So, for example, if a trans man is involved with a lesbian woman after transitioning, the question is whether or not that trans man is gay or straight. So like, that's not something you can easily resolve. That's a vexing question. Often enough, a trans man who's involved with a woman might not want to identify as straight. Certainly in the Pacific Northwest, he wouldn't. On the other hand, if that person, that trans man came from a family that was very religious and not at all accepting of homosexuality, it nonetheless might be a way for them to gain acceptance from their family to have transitioned, so they would appear straight. When everything is being made queer, then it's very difficult to make these determinations in a clear way. So I don't think you can separate out sexuality from gender identity. I don't think that the fact that many trans women or trans men identify still as queer or gay afterwards, it sheds any light on the issue at all, especially when you consider that just by being trans, you're officially now part of the LGBTQRST community and therefore gay, regardless of who you sleep with. So that the fact that Reed tries to fact check this with that argument, to me, indicates that at least on that point, she wasn't being very serious. Reed attempts to debunk the claim that the majority of gender dysphoric children would naturally desist if not affirmed by claiming that the studies that demonstrated this were methodologically flawed. Specifically, they included patients who did not fully desire to transition, she says. She provides no citation to validate this claim of a methodological flaw, but looking at the study, I see that it was specifically aimed at discovering what factors led to persistent gender dysphoria, and concluded that the intensity of gender dysphoria at an early age, so both intensity of gender dysphoria and how long it had been present, were important predictors, and that they should be used as a metric so that you don't bring into medicalization patients who may not actually ultimately desire to transition, who are simply having some gender confusion or who are gender nonconforming. So the point of the study itself was to try to create metrics to differentiate between different kinds of people who are having some distress around gender. And so it would make sense that it would include people who might not report having wanting to transition after a while. After all, they've desisted. So, you know, this again to me indicates that Reed isn't being particularly thoughtful in her debunking efforts here. I think I'll leave it there. But the point is, overall, the attempts to debunk have often been just repetitions of orthodoxy, which the orthodoxy on trans issues often isn't coherent, and that's led to so much of the skepticism about a treatment, which in some cases may be absolutely vital. But I do think it's important to take the WPATH file seriously, and to give a serious critique rather than repeat orthodoxy. I have other points that I could bring, but I you know, we're about 4 minutes to the end, so
yeah, let's go into those. Let's continue rethinking Reed's rethinking of the WPATH files in the parent room, and we'll answer some of these. I was just sort of throwing up all the comments on the screen. You know, Secret Asian Dan's getting mad at me again about something about you shouldn't go out in public if you're afraid of what thoughts people might have in their head. No, but the thing is, you can think whatever you want, but I'm not compelled to affirm that. Do you know what I mean? You can't drag me to court or make me lose my job because you want me to say things to you that get you off, but you can do that now, you know? So that's the thing that people are worried about. It's like, I now have to affirm your sexual proclivity on pain of losing my job or getting shunned from public life, or even being taken to court as J.K. Rowling is constantly threatened with, like every day. She's like, go ahead, take me to court. Like, she's like begging them to, she's like, don't worry, I got a team of lawyers that are ready to, like, let's have this out then. So yeah, that's the thing, is that you can't, like, you can think whatever you want in your head, but I don't know anything about it. Now it's like, no, now I have to know about it. And I can't say, if it makes me uncomfortable, I'm the problem. And, you know, I was talking to my friend the other day, and he was like, I think a big part of this is, not a big part, well, there were some comments in the chat that said this too, like male sexuality became really, really stigmatized in the culture as predatory and that sort of thing. And for some people, this is a form of male sexuality that is affirmed by the culture. And maybe that has a power to it. Maybe that has a draw.
I want to read a tweet that was aimed at you from somebody who you've muted, and then we can talk about it in the parrot room. Remember I told you this at the beginning, this anonymous DSA member? Is that all right if we end with this and then we can talk about it in the parrot room?
Sorry, you're still coming. How do you know about it? Well, I don't know, but if I say the wrong thing, you're going to let me know, aren't you? Like, how do I know? You might be, I don't know, have a 5 o'clock shadow, but that might be how I might know about it. But that's the thing, is that you don't know about it if the person passes. But interestingly, the people who pass tend to be the ones who are the gay men. Anyway. Let's talk about this in the parrot room.
I want to read this tweet. Ashley, I want to read this tweet before we go, right, from an anonymous DSA member, because I feel like it sets up what we'll talk about in the parrot room, which is going to be all of these trans issues arising in a moment where the attempt to control speech has reached a fever pitch, and you know they're attempting to be to grant the president of the United States the power to just decide which media companies can exist and which need to be shut down. And so this is the TikTok part of the stream, which we will only get to in the Parrot Room. But I want to read this tweet from an anonymous DSA member, and says, "No, I think we all acknowledge this is in response to you saying you're tired of people pretending like complicated political issues are really simple and you simply have to take one position or another and that you shouldn't debate it." And he said, you said you found that really annoying. And they say, "No, I think we all acknowledge that people can disagree with a specific point or issue, particularly civil rights matters. The question is, when we have an impasse, what happens? If you disagree with, say, my right to live in a neighborhood because I'm Black, do you get the chance to organize and bar me from living there? This is a fallacy at the center of the marketplace of ideas, ideology. It pretends as if these matters are entirely without stakes and value neutral. There are values behind these decisions, and people's personal rights and freedoms are affected by them. So I don't pretend that both sides are valid or hold equal moral weight. I'm honest about whose side I'm on and who I oppose, and I don't pretend like a compromise is valuable or even possible in many of these scenarios. So on the trans issue, one side is fighting for their rights to self-expression and respect."
What I'm criticizing. They're like, basic right, how could you society. Possibly be against this basic right? It's yeah. that
yeah. The other side is fighting to, now he's talking about you. The other side is fighting to ban and criminalize this form of self-expression by painting trans
literally
activists as groomers.
Not fighting to ban or criminalize this. Literally, right. It's amazing how people will completely like, do you not hear what I'm saying? Can you not hear me? Are my lips moving, but you don't make out the sound? I have said, play with your gender. Have fun. Dress, wear, you know, get, I will call you whatever you want to be called. I don't care. All good. Right? I think that there are some issues that we need to talk about that women are afraid because there is a sexual side of this. What do we do about that? Is it a big deal? Maybe it's not a big deal. I don't know. It scares me sometimes too, but maybe it's like, I think like sometimes I get swept up into panics as well. I'd like to be able to talk about this without getting called somebody who doesn't care about civil rights and want to ban people. Do you know what I mean?
Ashley, you say you don't want to ban things, but look, the WPATH files, if they are correct, and the and puberty blockers and hormonal treatment, and most especially the gender affirming care model, is a form of malpractice, then in fact, those who are advocating for this being taken seriously, for WPATH being taken seriously, are advocating for things being banned.
No,
like
they are
blockers
not.
For
no,
young. Yes,
no,
they are.
No,
and in fact,
no,
the puberty blockers were just banned in the UK.
No.
That's what
no.
just happened. Go
saying
ahead.
That there's an issue with this, and that maybe that like we need to take this all into account. It's not just all yay, wave your flags. Doesn't mean we should never do it. I never said that we should never do it.
No, I know, but they are being banned.
Yes, and this is the problem when we don't have an open conversation in society, when there's absolutely no, and it's not being banned, by the way. And Robin clarifies this in my podcast. But anyway,
it's not.
The fact that we are having a, like, we need to have open conversations in society, because what happens is when the other side gets the upper hand, they crush things and there's no fucking middle ground. You just get bans on everything. What I'm saying is there must be a middle ground between fucking getting the police on people's backs to force them to say your pronouns and like, and banning this shit and taking kids away from parents for not affirming and taking kids away from parents for affirming. Oh my God, everybody, calm the fuck down. Let's have a conversation about this. Okay.
Right.
That is what I'm saying.
That sounds good to me. But I do think that, well, okay, we'll talk about this more in the Parrot Room. People can go and join us there. I'll put the link to the Parrot Room side of this in as a comment. I'll pin that comment. It is in the description now. See you in the Parrot Room.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets